Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest and I hope the greatest chapter from Life on Planet Porky with myself, of course, the Porkmeister and rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Miss Jones, how are you feeling this morning? Your country, Wales, still part of the Union, but there's votes still to come in up in Scotland. Is there going to be an Indy Ref too? I mean, I fear for the breakup of the Union eventually, but I hope it never happens. I'm a unionist through and through. And in fact, in this very week, in 1770, I think it was, or 1773, the Act of Union was passed, and that brought us all together as one country. I hope we stay that way.
It's nail-biting stuff, isn't it, Mike? Yes. I mean, look, united we stand, divided we fall. It's the old adage, isn't it? We are sure. Small. The empire and the Commonwealth are vastly diminished. We've lost our alliance with Europe. We're not as big as we thought we were. So, no, we have to stick together. We absolutely have to.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think we got a bit of a raw deal around the world and historically about the British Empire. I thought it did quite a lot of good in many places. You know, it established sort of legal structures in lots of countries that didn't have them before we got there and all that. And nobody ever looks at the other empires which sort of came up and crashed, like the Roman Empire, which, you know, was horrendous, used slaves, fed Christians to the lions, or even the French, who ran some brutal regimes, you know, in places like the Caribbean and Southeast Asia. So I think all in all, I mean, obviously there were aspects of it which were terrible. But, you know, I don't think you can blame today's people for what people 200 years ago did.
Well, I agree with that. But there are that sort of debts of, you know, look, we did enslave people in our way. They may have got paid minimum wage and whatever else to create buildings and so on. We did plunder the resources of these countries and we brought a lot of stuff back that we shouldn't.
Yeah,
there is a hangover of responsibility.
Yes,
and that always remains. That's still there. So I just think we need to be citizens of the world, don't we, today?
Yes.
And we need to be mindful of each other. Mm. We're all supposed to be looking after each other in the modern day, not going, oh, we've got enough vaccine for our country, we're okay.
Yeah.
Got to be looking after other countries who've got nothing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Totally agree with that. Let's help best as we can. I think we're doing that with the old vaccine. Anyway, talking about politics just for a minute, on this day in 1979, Mrs. Thatcher came to power and started what could only be described as an historic chapter in British politics. I personally am a very big Thatcher fan. I thought she grabbed this country by the scruff of the neck. We were in the winter of discontent. Inflation was roaring, unemployment was roaring. And I think if Mrs. Thatcher had not got in that election, we would have ended up like what Greece is today, a smashed and ruined economy and a country that was once great gone to nothing. Do you think I'm being a little bit sort of over the top about Mrs. Thatcher?
Yes, you are a bit blind to her, the same as my former husband was, the great Thatch, he used to call her. But I have two bones to pick with her.
Oh, yes.
The miners' strike of 1984-95, which was an appalling blot on our history. Her Conservative government wanted to reduce the power of the trade unions, of course, and it resulted in pit closures that put thousands of people out of work. Of course, I feel strongly about that because of my coal mining roots in South Wales. The other thing, her right to buy campaign to sell off council houses has left us with a dearth of social housing problems. Council houses are still being sold off 3 times faster then local authorities can replace them. Yeah. And this is not what they were for. They were intended for key workers who had to live in inner cities so that they were available to do the necessary jobs, such as nursing, such as firefighting, such as policing, all of that. And yes. Now these people are forced to live way outside the cities and not be available for their shifts. I can't thank her for that, obviously.
Well, you see, my response to both of those is that mines were being closed down by the Labour government under James Callaghan anyway, because they'd become unprofitable and we were starting to import it. But that's just a counter argument. As for the council houses, so many people were enriched by being able to buy their own house. You know, suddenly there were property owners and it injected wealth into the economy in the country. But look, this is not a political debate. I was just saying that old Maggie Thatcher was there. She's long gone now. And life moves on. Now, old Craig David is 40 today, Leslie Ann. Is he any good?
Well, he's not really our era, is he? He's very successful. Songwriter, rapper, DJ, yeah. Producer. He's had 20 UK top 40 singles.
Really? I don't know one of them.
I couldn't really name you any of them.
No, I couldn't either. No.
7 UK top 40 albums. He's sold 15 million records around the world. He's been nominated for 14 Brits and 2 Grammys, but he's not a winner of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that kind of indicates, although he's obviously got a huge following, he's not up there in the top league, is he?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, I literally couldn't name one of his records. And if I was in the car and it came on the radio, I wouldn't know it was Craig David. So, excuse me. You know, I mean, some records you listen to, you think, oh, that's great. I wonder who that is. But I've never had that with Craig David. But then again, Sharon Stone was on the Gogglebox this morning. And she passed on a message to her best friend, Adele, who, funnily enough, has also got a birthday this week. She's pretty successful compared to Craig David, isn't she?
Well, she is, but in a whole different league, yes. Really. It's funny when I look at her because she's 33. She's the same age as my eldest daughter. Mm-hmm. And they were in the same class together at school, at the Brit School, yeah. Down in Croydon. Mm-hmm. Adele used to stack my dishwasher.
That's amazing. Because
I used to have all the Brit School kids around my house.
That is absolutely amazing because she always tries to come over, doesn't she? As, oh, I'm just a working mother, you know, go in with the kids, we get a takeaway in and all that kind of stuff. And for a woman who's got a fortune estimated about like 100 million, she is very down to earth. Talking about pop stars, Miss Jones, I've got to get to the bottom of this one. I flicked on the telly the other night. I was just sort of surfing through the channels. I saw, oh, Top of the Pops, the 80s. Oh, I'll have a look at that for a bit of a laugh, you know. A few great records in the 80s. Uptown Girl, Michael Jackson, Paul McCartney. Say what you want, but don't play games with my emotions. And all that kind of stuff, right?
That was very good, actually.
Thank you. That's very good. Thank you. Yeah. But one guy who came on, who I've never really taken notice of before, was a guy called Shalimar. And I'm watching him thinking, I don't really remember much about this guy. And then, amazingly, Shalimar performs the Michael Jackson moonwalk, you know, which was called, I think, the slide walk. And he's going backwards when he's leaning forwards. And I sort of looked it up and thought, I wonder if Michael Jackson complained about that, only to find that Shalimar invented the moonwalk.
Well, it's not quite as simplistic as that. First of all, Shalimar were a group. They weren't a single person.
Oh, really?
The guy you mean is Jeffrey Daniels, who was the sort of focal point. But then also in that band were Jody Watley, who was a big sex symbol even. And there was Howard Hewitt as well. People never remember him.
Howard Hewitt, but I don't remember him. I remember Howard Hughes, but not Howard Hewitt.
Howard Hewitt. The moonwalk was dubbed the moonwalk by Michael Jackson. So a lot of people thought he invented it. Yeah. But then LaToya, his sister, turned around years later and said, oh, Jeffrey Daniels taught my brother those moves. But in fact, that particular dance move, which it gives the impression of a dancer walking forward while the body is sliding backwards.
Yes.
And Michael Jackson performed this for the first time in public at Motown's 25th anniversary party.
I remember it.
In 1983. It was
Billy
Jean.
With Berry Gordy in the audience, right. And Diana Ross and everybody, yeah.
Yeah, and it was during Billie Jean that he performed that, and of course the crowd went wild. But we know that Michael Jackson studied Fred Astaire, James Brown, Gene Kelly, lots of other famous dancers. And in fact, Dick Van Dyke had performed similar moves in a televised sequence long before Michael Jackson came
Dick
along.
Dick Van Dyke.
Dick Van Dyke. But, and these moves
we love
were...
Mary Poppins. Yeah.
These moves were around in the 30s and the 40s. Yeah. And why people think that Michael Jackson invented the moonwalk is because he branded it the moonwalk. He gave it that name. Yeah. But the actual maneuver, that step, if you like, that had been around since the 1930s.
Yeah, it's I suppose it's because he was the most famous person in the world, or certainly the most famous pop star, singer, king of pop or whatever in the world. So the minute he did it and everybody saw it, it attached to him. Did you ever try it yourself at a drunken party? Because I spent the whole of the 80s trying to do that.
No, I would have gone arse over tit.
Please, Miss Jones, you know, it's not really ladylike the you know language, is it?
Well, it's the truth, isn't it? That's where I would have ended up. No, I used to jig a little bit on the dance floor in my younger day, but no, I could never have done anything so choreographically complicated. No.
Has anybody ever explained to you how it's done?
My son can do it.
Oh, really?
He went to where did he go? The Arts Ed. That's where he
sherry on the cornflakes this morning, Miss Jones.
No,
eh?
not yet. He went to Arts Ed, which is a performing arts school in Chiswick, which the patron is Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yes.
And he obviously had to dance, sing and act every single day for 4 years. Yes. And he can actually do it. It's not that difficult, I am told, but I leave that to the youngins, you know?
Yes, well, sure, yeah. I mean, I used to throw a few shapes, as they say, on the dance floor, flip my hip, call it what you like, but I could never master the moonwalk, which is...
You were a bit of a John Travolta, weren't you?
No, I didn't used to take my coat off and spin it around my head or anything like that, but, you know, I just liked sort of action on the dance floor, so to speak. Now then, I was going to talk to you about keyless cars, right? Because I was roundly mocked yesterday when a report appeared that keyless cars are the easiest cars to steal. And what the villains do is they can send a signal to the key in your pocket and they can get the code for that and they can steal the code. And then when you've walked away from the car, they can open the car by releasing that code into the car's computer system. Okay. And I've known about this for years. So a few years ago, I said to people, look, what you need to do is carry your car keys around in an empty tin of peas, because then the wicked villains who steal cars will not be able to steal your car because they won't be able to get their signal through the aluminium of the can. And I got roundly mocked for years. And guess what? It was revealed this week that the best thing to do is to put your keys into a metal box. I'm vindicated.
Is that an empty tin of peas in your pocket, or are you just pleased to see me?
Yeah, well, yes, I know exactly what you mean. But in those days...
I mean, you're not going to do it, are you? You're not going to carry a tin of peas or a baked bean tin or something around in your pocket with your car key in. What do we used to call them? They weren't called keys, were they? They were cards, I suppose. They were called
fobs. They were a fob. It was a fob that you just, you know, you press a button on it. In fact... When I used to have Jaguar cars, you didn't even press a button. The car automatically opened as you walked towards it if you had the fob in your pocket, you see. And and if somebody else walked towards the car thinking the door was open, they couldn't open it. It was that sort of thing. But no, I know what you mean. The first time I used a tin to protect it, I had a tin of mushy peas that I was eating with my fish fingers. And I washed out the tin, took the label off, obviously, scrubbed it all down. And then... Because in those days, and I still do, I carry a bag all the time, you know, all my journals in it and your pens and all that kind of stuff. And that goes in the back seat of the car, right? And then when I get out and I walk to the office, I put my keys into my tin inside my bag so that, you know, any evil villain standing nearby can't just flash his device and steal my code. I mean, I know I was roundly mocked for it, but I think I've been found to have come up with a winning formula, because three cars a day are now stolen by people who don't even know their car's missing, if you see what I mean. They can be stolen off the drive when you're asleep because they can sort of get their device through the letterbox and click onto it and all that kind of stuff. So I think the people who make cars in this world have got a responsibility to stop that happening.
They're going to have to change the technology, aren't they? Yeah. But I had four Renault Meganes in a row when I had young children. So they were very good cars for driving a lot of kids around, a lot of sports kit, all that kind of stuff. I had four of those in a row. And I always had a spare clicker. We used to call it the clicker. Always had a spare. And I never had a problem with them. But I suppose people don't necessarily want to steal a Renault Megane.
No. Well, they'll steal anything and get their hands on it. But no, you're absolutely right. I tell you what I've been catching up on this week, Leslie Ann, the fascinating history of the paper you worked for many years, the Daily Mail. And in particular, the two founders of it, Lord Harmsworth and Lord Northcliffe, were brothers, weren't they, who created almost separate newspaper empires. But what a fascinating story of pursuit and, you know, sheer bloody-minded will to get newspapers out and sell them. Only 30 years of age when they had the best-selling newspaper in the world. Absolutely fascinating stuff. And, you know, share it with our listeners because they like a Fleet Street story.
There was a book only a couple of years ago called Mailmen. I forget the name of the author, but it was the whole history of how the Daily Mail came to be and the story of these kind of warring families that brought this newspaper together eventually. Mm. We're reading about it, of course, because it's the 125th anniversary the newspaper, and they're delving into their archives as well as to their personal history as well. It is fascinating, yes, but times have definitely changed.
Oh, times have changed. One of the stories that they reprinted was the time that the then very famous editor, David English, who became Sir David English, died sadly of a stroke when I was employing his son at the Press Association. I employed his adopted son. One day he came into my office looking shocked and said, "Please, could I go home?" I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "My father's had a stroke." I said, "Your father?" I said, "Are you talking about David English?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "This is tragic." By that time, David English had moved up to become chairman of the company and Paul Dacre had taken over as editor. But 3 days later, David English sadly died, and it was a big shock to the whole newspaper community. But the point of my story is they reprinted the story of the Daily Mail hiring an aeroplane to fly to Saigon and bring back 100 orphans from Vietnam who would otherwise have perished, you know, after the end of the Vietnam War. It was a terrific story. And they flew them back to this country and they were all, you know, looked after and housed and home. But years later, I met a bloke called Brian Dixon, who worked for the Sun by then, but he'd worked for the Daily Mail, who got left behind during the refueling stopover on the way back from Southeast Asia. You know, they got off the plane to stretch their legs and all that, the fuel went on. And then Brian was having a cigarette or something, and all of a sudden he saw a plane taking off and thought, "That looks like my plane," and it was. And he was stranded in Southeast Asia for 10 days.
Oh, my goodness. How did he get back?
Oh, I don't know. They'd have found another way to get him back, I suppose, somewhere. Yeah. But I mean, that is a true newspaper campaign story, isn't it?
They used to do a lot of stunts like that, as we called them in those days, when there was more money around, because the circulations of papers were much greater. The advertising revenue was far bigger than it is today.
Yes.
And they had the money to spend on stunts like that. But it's like all those cover mount CDs. Do you remember those that the Mail on Sunday used to do? One every week. You'd have Eric Clapton's new album on the front of the paper on a CD. Yeah, and
that's
stuff.
Right. Sounds of the Summer and all this kind of stuff. Every time, you know, the Sun came out. I have still got somewhere, I'm not joking, a huge box of those giveaway CDs. And I was flabbergasted because they were real songs. I mean, initially they used to give you CDs with sort of cover versions on and all that, but these were actually, you know, Fleetwood Mac and everything. It was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were promotional deals with the artists' management themselves.
Yeah.
So the idea was that you'd get a few tracks on the CD, you'd play it and you'd love it and you'd go out and buy the album.
Yeah.
That was the benefit to the artists. And of course, they got paid as well for, well, the management got paid anyway, for, you know, the opportunity to... it was always before the release date. So it was a sort of taster for what was to come.
Yeah. Amazing.
And also, they started doing DVDs as well, because I remember I collected week after week the entire series of the original television version of Brideshead Revisited.
Really?
The one with Anthony Andrews and Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
I collected that week after week from the Mail on Sunday. And then one weekend, my daughter and I sat down and we watched the entire series off these giveaway DVDs.
Fantastic. I used to wonder why anybody ever went out and bought a record after they'd given them away in all the papers. But of course, you know, only a very small percentage, really, of the population reads one particular paper. So I can accept it was a promotional thing. Tell me who a lady called Amanda Eliash is, please, Leslie-Ann.
Ah, she's quite well known, actually. She's a photographer, artist, filmmaker, poet. She's quite a sort of glamorous woman about town.
Yeah.
She's been romantically linked with one Tim Rice since about 2007.
That's where it came to my attention. Oscar-winning lyricist Tim Rice has clearly left things on good terms with his erstwhile lover, Amanda Eliash. The socialite, 60, paid a visit to the Walk of Fame in Hollywood and could not resist bowing down to his star. I didn't know Tim Rice had a star on the Walk of Fame.
Oh, yeah, because, well, think about all the musicals and the films,
yep.
You know.
Yep.
The Lion King is just one example. But, yeah, I think she's carried a torch for Tim for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she at one point hoped that it would wind up in marriage and so on, but it doesn't seem to have done. He's 76 now.
Right.
So it's kind of all over on that front, isn't it?
Well, who knows? You know, people have ambitions, don't they? And we're all living longer and go on forever. I do hope war doesn't break out between us and France, Leslie-Ann, over the fishing rights around Jersey. That would be it'd be a bit of a problem, wouldn't it, in the English Channel?
This is not looking good. I think the Mail's headline yesterday was "Your Move, Macron."
Yeah.
And it's sort of inciting to riot, isn't it? It's very provocative, this kind of coverage.
Yes.
And it doesn't help. I think we ought to leave it to the politicians to sort this out rather than sort of he said this and she said that and then stabbing each other in the back and so on.
Yeah.
I think the papers ought to butt out of this one a little bit.
Well, I think we all got an opinion on it. In my view, it's another massive example of France and Europe not being able to accept the fact that we no longer want to be part of their club in Europe, you know, and the freedom of expression in this country, which said, no, we want to get out, is still resented terribly by the rest of the continent. And the French are like this. I mean, you've lived there, haven't you? And you know all about it. You know, they burn, you know, carcasses of sheep in the streets and they, you know, the drop of a hat, they'll have a blockade of something. Doesn't really matter what it is. I mean, they are very both nationalistic and extremely short-tempered, the French, aren't they?
I think there is a revolutionary element to their personality as well.
Yes, good expression.
They are resentful. They don't like the English, mostly. I lived in Paris during my degree for a year, and I would go into a bookshop, for example, and choose my books that I wanted to buy, take them to the till, and I would speak in what I thought was pretty good French.
Yeah.
And the salesperson would respond in disdainful English.
Really?
And I always thought that was rather cruel. You know, here I am doing my best. I'm only a student.
Yep.
They couldn't resist humiliating me. And I think there is that element of looking down their noses at us.
Yes.
Having said that, I wish we were still in Europe. I don't think this is going to play out to our advantage in any way.
Well, only time will tell with that, I'm afraid, because, you know, these things work in decades, I think, rather than years. But anyway, we will have to see. Right. OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in today. You're listening to myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, Miss Leslie-Ann Jones. And Leslie-Ann, I have to say the response to our last podcast was overwhelming. Tens of thousands of people tuned in and listened, and some very, very nice feedback.
Yeah, it's great to hear from people. Just the fact that the listeners take the time and trouble to you know, pause and send us a little message and so on. It's lovely to interact. Please keep it coming.
Yeah, definitely indeed. Now, of course, we're getting very close to the pubs reopening. That's a week on Monday. So that's, 11 days, 10 or 11 days, depending on...
Not that you're counting or anything.
Well, I've been counting since the day they closed in last November, believe me. And, you know, I can't believe how unlucky we've been to have had such bad weather through April and the early part of May, because, you know, some of the pubs near me in Stockbrookwell, sorry, have done so much to try and make it feel comfortable outside, big umbrellas, heaters and all that, but it simply isn't the same, is it, when it's cold? And as you said the other day, you know, you get your food and within 5 seconds it's gone cold and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, that's by the by. Another part of the industry that's opening up is the beach industry, because people are going to be allowed to mix when it gets to June. I mean, they can mix a bit now, but not altogether. But one aspect of that is that the donkeys are back on Blackpool Beach. And I have to say, I kind of shuddered at that. I didn't know we still had donkeys on beaches in this country. I thought that had gone decades ago. But B, I'm not sure I'm very happy that there are donkeys on beaches. Isn't that something that should have gone with the Victorian era?
I thought it was banned. I thought that, you know, that because of donkey preservation and all this kind of stuff, yeah. It was decided ages ago that this was very cruel. It's also incredibly unhygienic because of donkeys doing their business all along the beach and it never gets cleaned up properly and so on.
Yes.
There's always a big campaign about dogs not being allowed on beaches, yeah, during the summer months when children and adults are swimming in the sea and so on. Mm. We don't want all that washing off into the waves, do we?
No.
So I think all round this is a bad idea.
I totally agree, and it should be banned, but it's not. Like you, I thought it'd been banned. Here, I'll read this to you. Hang on. Here in front of me. Donkeys have returned to Blackpool Beach for the first time since lockdown. And it says, you know, vaccine boost helping and all that. In the latest sign of a great British summer just around the corner, seaside favourites are back entertaining families on the seaside. Owner Mark Einson said, "The donkeys, like me, are champing at the bit to go and meet and entertain our customers after a terrible 14 months. Have you ever been on a donkey ride on a beach when you were a kid?
Yeah, when I was very little, and we had family in Margate down on the Kent coast,
yeah,
and we always went down. My Auntie Gladys and Uncle Glenn had a guest house, quite a not market guest house, actually,
oh, yes,
in Westbrook. And we used to go to Westbrook Beach. We always stay. I used to think it was terribly posh because all the bedrooms had a wash basin,
wow,
in them. You know, that was
know
kind of
mean,
that
yeah,
was up market in those days, I tell you.
Oh, there was, there was even, sorry to interrupt, but, you know, when I was at first a young reporter and you have to go to some godforsaken town like Barrow-in-Furness or something, cover a story, you got a guest house, but there was a bathroom was down the corridor. There weren't even ensuite loos.
Yeah, no, but this was kind of a posh place.
Yeah.
There we would be with our rubber buckets and sort of wooden spades or, yeah, metal spades in those days.
Yeah.
And off we went down onto the beach. And then, yes, we would have donkey rides. And there was also a photographer with a great big camera with one of those big metal flash things attached to it. Do,
yeah,
you remember those?
Yes, I do.
He used,
yeah,
to stroll up and down the beach and take pictures of all the little children. Mm. And then your parents would be given a little ticket, yeah, with a number on it, and they could then go to the photographer's studio in the town,
yes,
and get the pictures of their kids and look at them and choose some and buy them there and, yeah, then on the spot. Because obviously no one had a camera.
No, and that's right. Yeah,
we,
yeah,
hadn't even dreamt of mobile phones in those days.
No, we certainly
but
haven't.
But yes, that was a beach holiday back then, and donkeys were a very big part of it.
Yeah, I do remember donkeys and some of the beaches we went to, but I never liked them. I always thought, you know, even as a kid of the age of about sort of 7 or 8, I thought they looked moth-eaten, the donkeys. They certainly didn't seem to enjoy their work, because have you ever seen a donkey smile?
Well, only if it gets the bit pulled right back against its face. Yeah. I mean, that guy is pretty stupid to say the donkeys are, well, champing at the bit to get,
yeah,
back,
yeah,
onto the beach. And,
yeah,
of course they're not.
No.
They'd rather be anywhere else.
Yeah.
Have you been to the New Forest where the donkeys all,
yes,
wander sort of wild?
Yes. Go on.
There are those terrible signs up on the side of the road telling you how many donkeys have been killed by cars,
yeah,
driving too fast,
yeah,
on the roads across the New Forest.
That's right.
Ponies as well. People just need to be a bit more careful. They're beautiful creatures. They're very gentle.
Yeah.
They belong in the New Forest, wandering about wild.
Yes.
And they don't belong on the beach.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with all of that. The place I go to sometimes when I go down to the coast, I go through the New Forest. I sometimes go to a place called Burley, B-U-R-L-E-Y, and that is the centre of pony stroke donkey land. And they literally come up to your table when you're sitting outside the pub and they try to nuzzle you and they try to get your food and all that kind of stuff. They're so incredibly tame. It's unbelievable. You know, I've fortunately never seen one knocked down because that would horrify me. And I think most motorists are fairly sensible. But inevitably, if you've got animals wandering around, you will, you know, you'll have the odd accident. But they are lovely creatures. One of those terrible adverts that breaks my heart on TV is the one for the donkeys. You must have seen it, where they're all loaded up with bricks and, you know, made to work 16 hours a day in terrible temperatures and heat. I hate that advert.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. And I think as well, we tend to turn away from those things now.
Yeah.
It's like when the starving kids in Yemen come on the television.
Yes.
And the person on TV is going, don't look away. And of course, everybody does now.
Yes.
There is immense compassion fatigue in the world at the moment.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. The adverts we're talking about are usually not on the main channels because they can't afford to advertise at the rates that, you know, ITV charges. They're normally on sort of the secondary channels, you know, like
London Live and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, something like that and all that because it's much cheaper to advertise. But like you, I have got terrible fatigue. I used to give money to Sightsavers and I stopped giving money to them. I've told this story before when I thought that they weren't appreciative of them, what I was doing. They wouldn't communicate with me. And I said, anyway, so all my money now, talking about donkeys, funny enough, goes to a charity run by Jenny Seagrove, the actress, who is a friend of mine. And it's called Main Chance. And it's down in Guildford in Surrey. And it's a huge couple of fields of horses that have been badly treated elsewhere. And it's a horse sanctuary. And I give the money directly to that charity because I know for sure it's going to be spent on putting up fences or buying feed or keeping the horses safe in the winter or something like that. And that's the only way now that I'm prepared to donate to charity. I won't give to something I've seen on TV because I think if they can advertise on TV, they've got more money than sense and they're spending it on the wrong thing.
What worries me, I've got a couple of friends who've worked for big charities in the past.
Yes.
And these people have been very highly paid.
Yes, very highly paid,
and
I agree.
And they get great expenses. Yeah. Now, all of that money comes out of what people donate.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean,
it makes you think, doesn't
it?
I mean, in the old days, charities were run by the wives of rich landowners and viscounts and lords and all those kind of people.
Sure.
And this was a way of, you know, their family giving back, I suppose. So charities were run once upon a time by people who were not paid.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
What do you think?
Well, I mentioned that I used to run the Press Association already in this this podcast, but one time there, a secretary came to me and she was very good. She's more like a, you know, a PA. She would, you know, get all these sort of, you know, things together, you know, print stuff out and all that kind of stuff. And she came to me and she said, oh, I'm really sorry, but I'm leaving. And I said, oh, that's a terrible shame. Where are you going? Thinking she might be going to another newspaper or something. You know, she said, oh, I'm joining. She told me the name of some charity. And I said, oh, really? I said, what are you going to do there? She said, oh, help raise funds. And I said, OK. In those days, I was paying her about 22,000. She was going to the charity for 45,000.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that says it all.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it. I said, what? You know, to do what? And all that kind of stuff. Basically, to ring people up and ask them to send you some money. But anyway, there we are. Now, Miss Jones, you are a woman of very young years compared to me. But do you remember the very famous gymnast from Romania called Nadia Comăneci?
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah. This was the, wasn't it the 76 Montreal Olympics?
I think it was, yeah. I think
my father was at that. My father covered those Olympics. So
exactly.
I do remember her because it was very interesting how we were going crazy over here about how popular she was and how brilliant. But Dad said that in Montreal, there was very little attention being paid to her. It was very much a media-driven exposure that she got.
Yeah.
But of course, she was famous for the first ever perfect 10 for the uneven bars routine.
Yeah.
And she was Romanian during the time of the communist era, secret police and all that.
Ceausescu.
And she suffered unbelievable brutality. Behind all that glamour and success, she was being treated appallingly and humiliated, starved, beaten by her coach. And now this has all come out in a new book called Nadia and the Securitate by a writer, a historian, actually, called, I think this is the right pronunciation, Stergerel Olaru.
Oh, right. OK. Well, I knew it was a book coming out because that's what drew my attention to it. And I read a review of the book and you're absolutely right. The regime was brutal. She was spotted at 6 years of age in a school playground doing cartwheels. And, you know, somebody who was like in the world of gymnastics or something said, God, she looks very supple and all that kind of stuff. She was virtually then kidnapped from her parents and spent the next sort of 8-9 years because she got all the medals when she was 14, by the way, in Montreal. But she spent the next sort of 8 or 9 years just being intensively trained and came up, you know, to be the greatest sort of gymnast, female gymnast of all time, getting 10 out of 10 for everything for the first time ever. But you're absolutely right. And reading the review of the book that I read, she apparently had to be as hard as granite and never give in to her captors, you know, the people who trained her, because the minute she did, she felt they'd won and she'd lost her individual personality. And of course, when she got old enough and when she could get away, she left Romania and went to America, of course, and that's where she still lives. But it is a horrifying story of what those little girls were put through.
She was hit until her nose bled,
yeah,
and she was punished with physical exercise until she collapsed.
Yeah,
she was tormented, intimidated. Her coach, who was Bella Carol Lee, he used to call her a fat cow and a pig. And
terrible.
By the way, that coach defected to the US with his wife as well in 1981. And he still denies all the allegations.
But they ended up, him and his wife, ended up running the American gymnast teams. They didn't care. The Americans didn't care about all these allegations of bullying little girls. No, no, no. And it's a bit like the German scientists who left Germany after the Second World War. You'd have thought, oh, right, we better lock them up. No, no. The Americans took them and they helped America land on the moon.
Yeah, so it's begs all the questions, this, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it's the way the world works, I think. But I went to Romania and I was foolish to go because I'd not long got out of hospital after I'd been waiting for my heart transplant for 7 months and decided to come off the transplant register. And I was trying to sort of make life normal again. But I didn't have a lot of work because I was still unable to actually, you know, convince people that I was back and ready and fit because they thought I should have had a heart transplant. Anyway, I foolishly, Everton were drawn away to Dynamo Bucharest. And I thought, I'm going to go because, you know, I've been a very passionate Everton fan all my life and to see them overseas would be great. And I had the time. So madly, I decided to go. So I organised a ticket through the club and organised the air ticket and all that, the flight. And I literally went and I had no idea how I was going to operate away from home without having a British hospital near me in case I collapsed or anything. It was the most ridiculous thing I ever did. But what a fascinating country Romania was. It was then liberated after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And the one thing I do remember, and I've said this many times before, is that every waitress in the hotel I stayed in wore a miniskirt, had very, very long legs, and was on the lookout for not even a rich Westerner, but any Westerner who might want to take it back to their Western country.
Well, that's pretty ugly, isn't it, really?
Very ugly. When you retired for the evening, the concierge guy would say, OK, Mr. Parry, you are right. I said, yes, fine, thank you. Is there anything we can do for you? I said, no, thanks. No, I don't need an alarm call or anything like that. I see. Is there anything else? I said, well, you don't have any English newspapers, so I don't require a paper in the morning. And anything else, sir? And in fact, the offer was on that they would send a woman to your room, no problem at all, if you fancied it.
Did you avail yourself of this facility?
No, I didn't. And I say that in all honesty.
Your excuses and left.
I made my excuses and left. I've never availed myself of that facility. But I tell you how rife it was when the guy... So I come out the airport in Bucharest and there's just a line of taxis, but they're not taxis like you get in the West. They were like beating up old cars, you know what I mean? And doors hanging off and all sorts of things. And so I get in this taxi and I thought, I'm going to need a driver for the next 2 or 3 days. So I said to this guy, look, give me your phone number. And he had an office. I don't think he had a mobile phone, just an office you could ring or his home or something. And I said, whenever I need you to go anywhere, I'll give you a call. I want you to take me to the game tomorrow night and then pick me up after the game and all that. Yes, yes. Yeah, Mr. Mike, no problem, you know. And then as we got near to the hotel, he said, Mr. Mike, I warn you, you watch the concierge guy. I said, why? He said, he will try to give you a woman. And I said, right, okay. He said, just don't do it. My sister is better. And
oh, no.
Yeah,
the guy's pimping her own sister.
Honest to God. Yeah, honestly.
His own sister. Oh, that's hideous. That's even worse.
I know. It's absolutely terrible. But that's the way it was. And I remember when we were leaving, I've told this story before, but many years ago. So he was taking me to the airport on leaving, and obviously got to know me over the 2 or 3 days. He said, "Oh, Mr. Mike," and he had this broken down cassette player in the broken down car. You know, he says, "I know what you like, so I have you a tape of ABBA." I said, "Oh," I said, that's good of you." "Yes, yes, I bought it for lots of money, but it's for you, for the journey to the airport." I said, "Great, thanks." And he pushes it in, and the sound that comes out was, "Billy, don't be a hero, don't be a fool with your life." And I didn't have the heart to tell him it wasn't ABBA. It was, what were they called, Black Magic or something.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah. They were a sort of cover band.
Yeah, they were. Billy, Don't Be a Hero, that's right, yeah. But anyway, there we go. But an amazing country, trying to, you know, shake off the shackles of communism and all that, but, you know, not very successfully, and they are. But you're worried about going to those countries, and Russia as well, because you honestly never know. Whether one night you get into a taxi, you don't know where it'll take you, and you don't know whether your drinks might be laced. Whenever you go to Russia, you're always warned never to leave your drink when you're in a bar. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, well, they tell young girls not to do that in a club in this country as well.
Well, of course, yeah.
You know, if you go to the ladies, take your drink with you, especially if it's a bottle of beer or something.
Yeah, no.
Because Rohypnol or something worse can easily be dropped into it.
Oh, yeah.
But do you remember all those terrible stories about the orphanages in Romania? Full of babies and tiny
terrible,
children.
Terrible.
And I remember reading one thing that stuck in my mind all this time, yeah. How the babies no longer cried because nobody ever came to attend to them. So they learned the hard way not to cry anymore.
It's all heartbreaking stuff, isn't it? And every time I read one of those, I just thank my lucky stars that I was born in this country. I still think we're the most civilized country in the world for all our failings. That, you know, there are problems, obviously, but my goodness me, I think if you were born in this country into a middle-class home in the era that I was, and maybe yourself, you won life's lottery, really, didn't you?
Yeah, we did in lots of ways. Yeah, there are improvements we could make. We know what they are. But yeah, compare ourselves to many regimes around the world. And yeah, we struck lucky, didn't we?
Yeah, we certainly did. And this week, what year was it? I think it was 1979 or 80. The first of the hunger strikers, called Bobby Sands, died in Belfast. And I was working there. I worked there for about 3.5 months, right the way through the hunger strikes. My goodness me, was that a tense and scary and difficult and mind-blowing place to be. Honestly, it was amazing. They had some sort of like bush telegraph. And the first time you knew that a hunger striker had died was when you suddenly started hearing a clanging and banging noise. And what happened is the people come out of the houses and they start banging the dustbin lids on the pavements. And that's a bush telegraph to indicate another hunger striker has died. And that was before the authorities even knew about it. That's the sort of society it was.
I've never really understood the whole point of hunger striking. Yes, you become a martyr.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very horrible thing to do. But what ultimately does it achieve?
Well, you see, once again, we've mentioned Mrs. Thatcher once in this podcast already, but it was to test Mrs. Thatcher's resolve. They wanted to wear clothes that were their own and not a prison regulation outfit, if you see what I mean. It's all about really, you know, what prisoners should wear to define whether they were political prisoners or criminal prisoners, and they wanted to be classed as political prisoners. That's basically it. But they decided to go on hunger strike and just test the resolve of the British government led by Mrs. Thatcher, and she never gave in. I think it was 12 in the end. But you are absolutely right. I never agreed with any of the principles of the IRA or, you know, republicanism or shooting people or anything like that. But anybody who suddenly believes in something so strongly is prepared to starve themselves to death. I can't imagine it. I just can't imagine. It is, as you quite rightly say, the most terrible way to die. They have to put a cage over your body after about 2 and 3 weeks because your skin is so sensitive, the cotton on the sheets, you know, would cause you immense pain and all that kind of stuff. So, yes.
No, it's horrible. Didn't Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe, who's obviously in Iran, under arrest. Yeah. Didn't she go into hunger strike at one point?
I think she did, but I think you realise, and that guy Navalny in Russia was on hunger strike, wasn't he? But,
yes.
But you have to, you know, I think you do it for about a week, and I think you realise what you let yourself in for. The problem is, after about 16 or 17 days, apparently, your organs are so incapacitated, you never recover. So you've crossed the line then, you know what I mean? And then you just have to keep going till the end. It is absolutely horrible. But I have to say, it was a desolate period. And, you know, you think of people starving themselves to death and the war of attrition that was going on there, Ian Paisley and, you know, Martin McGuinness. And, oh, it was a horrible place. And there's still problems in Ireland. We know that Northern Ireland, Brexit has accentuated some of them. But I am very glad that, you know, there was some resolution to it all on the Good Friday Agreement. And you hope it never happens again. We talked about Michael Jackson a bit earlier. His mother, Catherine Jackson's 91. That's a fair old age. I didn't even realise she was still alive.
Yeah, the father's dead, Joe. Yeah. He died a while ago.
Yeah.
The things she saw, the things she had to put up with. I met her. She's a very meek woman, very
really?
Devoted to her family.
Yeah.
And the father was an absolute monster.
Yes.
Used to thrash the kids with his belt and force them to rehearse night after night, put them out on the road when they were still little kids at school, where, of course, they witnessed all kinds of things that they were far too young to see. And, yeah, they were corrupted, really, by that whole lifestyle which the father imposed. People sometimes have said, why didn't Catherine stand up to her husband
and
refuse to allow him? But she didn't have what it takes to do that.
No, I totally agree. It was surreal. But then again, we've discussed this before. Where's the equation between, you know, having to be sort of very, very stern with your children, the success it brings them, like the Williams sisters and all that. Just talking about famous people, pop stars and film stars. Audrey Hepburn was born on this day, 1929. Said to be one of the most charismatic actresses ever. Now, I know she wasn't from your era. In fact, she didn't die till 1993. But did you ever see any of her films and think, wow, this is mind-blowing?
Yeah, I watched Breakfast at Tiffany's a few times, and Sabrina was another one I've seen. My daughter's got one of those box sets, you know, of DVDs, and we sat and watched a few of those over time. She did have a very special quality that came through on celluloid, didn't she? She lit up the camera.
Yeah.
And there was an innocence about her which seems to have been genuine.
Yeah, no,
and she had a quirkiness, a kind of humour about her. She was unique. There hasn't been anybody else like her.
Really? Yeah, that's interesting. What was Breakfast at Tiffany's all about? Because I used to go to Tiffany's and buy presents for people back in England, because we all earned very good money in New York. So you'd go to Tiffany's, the jewellers, and I'd buy, you know, when my niece was born, I bought her a little bauble you get for a baby. I don't know what it's called, but I used to buy...
A rattle or something,
That's right, yeah. I bought her a solid silver rattle, which she's still got, you know, sort of 30-plus years later and all that. But I look back on it now and I think, hang on, I don't remember there being a restaurant there where people had breakfast.
No, there wasn't. This referred to her character with a pastry in a paper bag, which she bought from a, you know, an on-street seller of pastries and whatever else.
Yeah.
And she'd go with this pastry early in the morning and stand at the window of Tiffany's gazing at all the jewels she couldn't afford to buy.
Really?
Oh, so I that see. Was her having breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, I see. That's
but she was a bit of a kind of escort girl, wasn't she, really?
This was never
spelled out in the film, obviously, but nowadays people are asking questions.
Yes.
She was really an escort. She was being paid by a long-term prisoner in Sing Sing jail to pass messages and to visit him and people on the outside. He was obviously involved in the mafia and so on, and somebody would give her a little code message. She would go in and visit him and pass on the message. So she was a sort of go-between.
Golly.
Probably quite innocently, but she was being paid to do that. So she was a gangster's mole, really.
Audrey Hepburn. There you go.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, Ms. Jones, is it a bank holiday week? I know that was last weekend.
No, we just had one of those.
That's right. Yeah, but there's another one coming at the end of May, and that's the mistake I've made, because when it comes at the end of May, the pubs will once again be open. and we'll all be able to go inside and have a proper bank holiday for the first time in a year. Whoopee, I say.
Hooray, can't wait. And a drink between us is long overdue. So
it certainly is.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
After the 17th, we'll get out there and we'll paint the town red or blue in my case.
Every other colour under the sun, yeah.
Right, so Miss Jones, farewell and take care. And to our millions of listeners, thank you very much indeed for joining us. We'll be back with you again very soon. Did you ever try it yourself at a drunken party? Because I spent the whole of the 80s trying to do that.
No, I would have gone arse over tit.
Please, Miss Jones, you know, it's not really ladylike, the, you know, language, is it?
Well, it's the truth, isn't it? That's where I would have ended up. No, I used to jig a little bit on the dance floor in my younger day, but no, I could never have done anything so choreographically complicated. No.
Has anybody ever explained to you how it's done?
My son can do it.
Oh, really?
He went to where did he go? Art Center. That's
where
he
went. Sherry on the cornflakes this morning, Miss Jones.
No, not yet.
So I get in this taxi and I thought, I'm going to need a driver for the next 2 or 3 days. So I said to this guy, give me your phone number. And he had an office. I don't think he had a mobile phone, just an office you could ring, or his home or something. And I said, whenever I need you to go anywhere, I'll give you a call. I want you to take me to the game tomorrow night and then pick me up after the game and all that. Yes, yes. Yeah, Mr. Mike, no problem, you know. And then as we got near to the hotel, he said, Mr. Mike, I warn you, you watch the concierge guy. I said, why? He said, he will try to give you a woman. And I said, right, okay. He said, just don't do it. My sister is better.
Is that an empty tin of peas in your pocket, or are you just pleased to see me?